The Retirement Conversation is a series of episodes on the changing nature of retirement today. These conversations are focused on the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition, including career, work, purpose, wellness, social relationships, and leisure pursuits. You'll hear from leading experts in the field. You'll hear the stories of people who have created interesting second acts. You'll find out about practical ideas and tips to create your own. Retirement Wisdom was co-founded by Joe Casey and Dennis Wussman, two former business executives turned professional coaches. At Retirement Wisdom, our mission is to save people from a boring retirement. We hope you enjoy the series and conversations.
Emily Esfahani Smith is a journalist and the author of The Power of Meaning, Finding Fulfillment in a World Obsessed with Happiness. Her articles and essays have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The New Criterion, and other publications. She is a former managing editor of The New Criterion. Smith is also editor at the Stanford University's Hoover Institution, where she advises the Ben Franklin Circles Project, a collaboration with the 92nd Street Y and Citizen University to build meaning in local communities. Emily was born in Zurich, Switzerland, and grew up in Montreal, Canada. She now lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband, Charlie. Emily, thanks again for joining us today. And is there anything you want to add to this, to your bio, besides what we read here?
Thanks for having me. And no, I have nothing I'd like to add. I think you covered it.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Emily, if some of our listeners are not familiar with positive psychology, how would you describe it? And what led you to study it?
So positive psychology, it's the field that I write about most, and it's a subfield within psychology that is concerned with the study of the positive elements of life. So for a long time, psychologists have just been concerned with the negative, like depression, anxiety, neuroses. And about 20, 25 years ago, a group of psychologists said, hey, we need to come around together and empirically study the other side of the spectrum, things like happiness and meaning and how we have deep and meaningful relationships, character, creativity, this whole kind of basket of human experience. And, you know, the field was founded in 1998, and there's just been a whole lot of research that's come out of it that's informed how we can lead deeper, better lives. And I came across it about 5 or 6 years ago when my dad gave me a book called The Happiness Hypothesis by the social scientist Jonathan Haidt. And the book, it was just really, it's a beautiful book. I highly recommend it. And it just was really eye-opening to me. I hadn't studied psychology in college. I studied philosophy. And this book kind of brought together ancient wisdom from philosophy and spiritual traditions together with modern psychological research to give us some ideas about what, you know, where we can find true happiness. And in the book, he mentions positive psychology. I started, you know, Googling around about what this field was. It seemed very much in line with my own interests, and eventually found out that there was a master's program in positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And so I applied to that, got in, and as a student started writing about the ideas that we were learning about, things like meaning and relationships, those articles became the basis of this book I wrote called The Power of Meaning.
You mentioned happiness. There certainly has been a happiness craze. I think I read somewhere that 40 books were published in 2000, and 10 years later, there were more than 4,000, from 40 to 4,000. Your book makes a compelling case that living a good life is less about pursuing happiness and much more about meaning. Could you tell us more about that?
When I was studying positive psychology, a couple of things, you know, struck me. One was that there was this kind of obsession with happiness in our culture, and that a lot of the positive psychology research, by focusing on happiness, was fanning those flames. It was kind of giving the media more to write about, giving authors more material to include in their books. And so you see, with the rise of positive psychology research, this kind of explosion in articles and books on happiness. At the same time, there was this kind of other branch of research that was starting to develop around the question of meaning and how to live a meaningful, purposeful life. And what really intrigued me was that this newer body of research revealed that this obsession with happiness that we have, pursuing it single-mindedly the way we're encouraged to do, can actually lead us astray. It can actually make us unhappy and feel lonely and anxious. But that when we orient our lives to the pursuit of meaning and purpose instead of happiness, and let that be what guides us, then we end up leading a kind of richer and deeper life.
And we often work with clients who are transitioning from corporate life on one of your pillars, purpose. They typically have had a clear purpose, and now there's a need for them to redefine it. Personally, I used to think of purpose as a lofty thing, something that would require a minimum month-long retreat to the Himalayas. But you write about it in a much more accessible way, so there are much more accessible pathways to purpose. And I found that you demystified it in your book. How can people find or rediscover their purpose?
I see so much what you're talking about, that people think of purpose in this grand, almost spiritual way. And one of the things I wanted to do with my book was, as you suggest, bring purpose down to earth a little bit, because if it's so grand and so out of reach, like going to the Himalayas, then that means that few of us can actually accomplish it. But that's untrue. There are ways to find purpose just all around us. You know, I think that a way to think about purpose is just that people find purpose in doing whatever it is that they're doing well. So if you're a parent, like parenting, doing a good job at parenting, if you're, you know, washing the dishes, like doing a good job with that, and realizing that these small acts of purpose, what makes them purposeful is that they connect to something beyond yourself. So, you know, I think parenting, when I talk to people, you know, what gives your life purpose? Children is something that comes up again and again, because it's this project that's bigger than you are. And it is making this major contribution to society, you know, by raising people to kind of be citizens, and also it makes a contribution to their lives because you're investing into the growth and development of your kids. Stepping away from relationships, there are also kind of the tasks and the projects of daily life, whether it's work or our hobbies, that we can find purpose in by, again, understanding how those tasks connect to something bigger. So, you know, if you work in a job and you think it's like really terrible and you'll never find meaning in it because you're doing something that doesn't seem on its face to be meaningful, like you're a clerk or you're an accountant or whatever, I think finding purpose lies in two things: reframing how you think about that job and understanding the service that it's contributing. And every job, every company exists because it's filling some need in the world. So connecting to what that need is and remembering that, you know, what you're doing is filling that need. So if you're an accountant, you're helping someone who is, you know, or a company who is, you know, terrified by the tax code and the tax world. You're kind of making their lives easier by applying your expertise. That's the first thing, is kind of reframing. And the second thing is adopting a service mindset. So finding ways to, again, serve others in the work that you're doing, whether that means helping a colleague with a project or understanding how your work makes an impact, whether it's a big impact or a small impact.
I find that service mindset so important, especially for leaders in organizations. They sometimes don't recognize the fact that they could have a really important impact on people that they are that work for them. And the same thing could be said of a child, or could be said of anything. But if people had that mindset, it doesn't have to be, you said before, find purpose in doing what you're doing and do it well. And sometimes people look for this big, grandiose thing. You know, I have to do X, Y, Z, whatever that is. It's real big, but it starts within yourself, and it actually is expressing. It's the individual expressing what it is that's important to them and giving it to others. Is that a fair way to kind of think about that?
I think so, exactly. So it's, you know, the idea is that we all have kind of a unique cocktail of strengths and talents and experiences that make us who we are. And these are things that, you know, if we cultivate and put out into the world through the work that we do, through the relationships that we develop and nurture, that's kind of the act of living with purpose. It's taking the best in you and using it to serve others.
Another one of your pillars is the storytelling pillar. And I personally love what you've written about the benefits of storytelling. How can storytelling benefit all of us?
So storytelling is an interesting one, I think, anyways. And when I tell people about it, they kind of are intrigued by it. So storytelling is less about the stories that we tend to think of that we interact with day to day. So the movies, the television shows, the novels. I'm not talking so much about those kinds of stories. What I'm really talking about are the stories that we tell ourselves, about how we became the people that we are today. So how I became who I am, how you became who you are. What's the story that you're telling yourself about that? So there's kind of the long arc of that story, the story of who you are, the grand narrative of who you are. And then there's also the stories that are more local, like the stories that we tell about why this happened to us, you know, yesterday afternoon, or, you know, why is it that, whatever, if you're having a hard time finding a job, like, why do I keep getting rejected in my interviews, or why is it that I seem to be attracting so much, you know, goodness and luck? So how do we make sense of these events around us? That's all storytelling. And I think that we don't always realize that, A, we're constantly kind of crafting these narratives and telling these stories about ourselves, and that, B, we are the authors of our own stories, and that means that we can change the way we're telling them, of course, while respecting the facts. But, you know, we make narrative choices about which facts to include in the stories that we tell, and sometimes that means leaving out facts that, if we include them into it, could help us change our perspective on something. And that's especially important if you're telling a story that's kind of holding you back instead of moving you forward.
Appreciate that. And one thing we see is when people decide it's time to move on from corporate life, their identity shifts and many of their relationships can also change. What have you learned about the importance of belonging, and how can people cultivate that later on in life?
Belonging. So belonging is really about being in a relationship or being part of communities where you feel valued, you are intrinsically, other people value you, and when you value other people for who they are intrinsically. So for a lot of people, you know, they will find belonging at work, but not everyone will. I mean, there are a lot of people who have toxic office environments where they're treated instrumentally or just not treated very well at all, or they're valued just for their achievements or whatever the case may be, and not for who they are actually. But if you're one of these people who does find a sense of belonging at work, and then you leave work and you're searching to recreate that experience, there's so many ways. I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm involved with is a project called Ben Franklin Circles. And these are these like little small groups, these communities that have popped up all around the United States. And I run one of these circles here in Washington, D.C. And the idea is that you get, you know, a small group of 10 to, you know, 12 people together. And you come together and you talk about one of Franklin's 13 virtues. So he had these 13 virtues he thought were critical to leading a good life. And so we talk about one of the virtues, maybe it's humility, maybe it's industriousness. And we talk about how these ideas, whether they're still relevant, whether they're old-fashioned, how they play themselves out in our life today and in society more generally. And what I've been struck with running this in D.C., and we've only been meeting for a couple of months, once a month, is how quickly a sense of belonging develops within the group and how quickly people were willing to open up and make themselves vulnerable and go really deep so that the community really felt like something special. And one takeaway for that is, you know, start a Ben Franklin Circle or do something like that, you know, create community. But I think the other takeaway is that when we come around and gather around to talk about, to think about our common values, a common project that we're all engaged with, that's one way to build belonging.
Belonging is not a solo act, the way I kind of hear it. It's real important to be connected with others, family, community, work, etc. Once that common ground is met there, it can pay. It can have some really powerful benefits. So appreciate that. I think that's one of the takeaways I had. It's just not a solo act.
Exactly. No, that's right. It absolutely requires another person at least, if not, you know, another group.
It's a great point that you can create that community. It's something that's within our control. You also write about transcendence and how people connect to things outside of themselves. Could you share some examples of how you see people doing that and what are the benefits to that?
So when I was writing my book, I, you know, it was there were some kind of pillars of meaning that seemed obvious to me, like belonging and purpose. When you talk to people about their experiences, about what makes their lives meaningful, they mentioned that, you know, their jobs, their relationships, things like that. But then there was this whole other category of experience that seemed to share something in common. And that commonality I call transcendence. So these are experiences like being in nature and feeling a sense of oneness, you know, walking in the woods or seeing the Grand Canyon and feeling a sense of awe and wonder, and like your own sense of self is smaller because what lies before you is so big. Or, you know, going to a church service, praying, meditating, these moments that kind of still your mind and that, again, connect you to something bigger. What they all share in common, I found, was that they're all about doing something or having an experience where your sense of self feels smaller, all the noises in your head, all your daily concerns kind of become less significant as you feel connected to something much bigger than yourself, whether it's the universe or God or nature or humanity. There's this feeling of kind of oceanic expansion. And these experiences can exist on a spectrum. So, you know, there are kind of, you know, minor moments of transcendence you might have during the day, like art museum, seeing a beautiful work of art and just being so absorbed in it. Or, you know, for me, when I'm writing as a writer, sometimes I'll kind of get lost in the zone, feel like I'm in a state of flow where I feel like, you know, time and place have dissolved and I'm just so engaged in what I'm doing. There's also, you know, these major experiences of transcendence where, you know, there's a whole new body of research growing up around how drugs like psilocybin, hallucinogenic drugs, can induce a transcendent experience and the effect that that has on people. So that would be classified as a major transcendent experience. Or I've spoken to people who've meditated who said that, you know, when I was meditating, you know, my sense of self just completely dissolved. There was no me anymore. The result was that I felt this sense of union with everything around me. So those would be on the other side of the spectrum.
So your book is jam-packed with great research that you make accessible to people like me. And there's a lot of interesting stories in there as well. But you also tap into the wisdom of great thinkers, philosophers, and notable people across history, which was impressive. Which one or two would you highlight that really resonated with you? And what did you learn from them?
Of the thinkers or of the people I interviewed?
Let's go with the thinkers.
Okay. So the person who immediately comes to mind is Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor. He, in 1942, he was transported to a Nazi concentration camp. He was Jewish, and he and his family were taken to this camp. And 3 years later, when the camp was liberated, most of his family had died, but he'd survived. And he ended up writing a book that, you know, within a year or two of the liberation, called Man's Search for Meaning, which was about his experiences in the camps. And what he found in that book, I think, is really powerful. He talks about how, you know, everything can be taken from someone, your liberty, your dignity. Many of the people who were in the camps lost their children, the people they loved the most, their wives, whatever. And understandably then, many of them gave up on life and decided there was nothing left to live for. But there were some people who continued to hold on to a sense of meaning and purpose, and this gave them hope. Those who found meaning in their suffering, Frankl said, were even more likely to survive the general degradation of camp life. And we see this in the modern empirical research around meaning as well, that people who have a sense of purpose are more resilient in the face of suffering, and they do indeed live longer. There's something powerful about having something to live for that kind of powers you through, and so it's really interesting. So, you know, Frankl's insight that human beings are meaning-seeking creatures. We have a yearning for meaning the same way we have a yearning for food and water and shelter, and that without that yearning being satisfied, we suffer in all kinds of ways. And B, that it's critically important to find meaning amidst our suffering, those are two of his insights that resonate most strongly with me. The other thinker, let me think. The other thing, of course, to mention would be Aristotle. So Aristotle kind of said so much that's so relevant to our lives today in all kinds of ways, but especially on this topic. And he said that a good life lies in a Greek word that is eudaimonia. And a lot of people translate eudaimonia as happiness, and they say that Aristotle said that the whole point of a man's life is to pursue happiness. But eudaimonia actually means flourishing. And he believed that the way that people led a good life, that the way that they flourished, was by pursuing virtue and excellence. So being good and doing good and being engaged in the community and cultivating the best within us and realizing our end, our purpose. And he contrasted this pursuit with the pursuit of hedonia, or happiness and pleasure, and said that, you know, that pursuit, that's kind of, for a lot of people, he said, think that's what the purpose of life is, but actually that's a life for grazing animals. It's a vulgar life, and that what we want to pursue as human beings is this nobler vision of living well.
You're definitely inspiring me to go search for great thinker bobbleheads, or at least baseball cards. And is there anything that jumps out from when you think of the interviews you did? Was there one person or one story that really resonated with you?
There was. So there's this story that I write about in the chapter on belonging, which highlighted to me how we can cultivate belonging in unlikely places and in unexpected ways. So my friend Jonathan lives in New York, and he's the one who this story's about. And he told me, you know, every day, he said, I had this morning routine where I go and I buy a newspaper from the same street vendor in New York. And over the years, Jonathan and this street vendor have developed a little bit of a relationship, because they don't just stop and exchange money for goods and have merely a business transaction, but they stop and they talk to each other, they ask each other questions, how they're doing, and they treat each other like human beings. And that leaves them both feeling valued and like they matter to the other person. And so they leave feeling elevated. Well, one time, Jonathan goes to buy the newspaper, and he realizes that he doesn't have the right change. And the vendor notices this, and he says, you know what, don't worry about it. This time, the paper's on me. But Jonathan felt uncomfortable with that, so he insisted on paying, and he went to the store and bought something he didn't need to make the change. But when he went to give the money to the vendor drew back. He was hurt. He was trying to do something kind and generous for Jonathan and to kind of raise the level of intimacy within their relationship. But Jonathan had rejected that bid for intimacy and affection. And I just think that's really powerful, because I think that we don't always realize the impact of these small actions that we have and small behaviors on other people. And we don't always realize that these little moments are so packed with meaning, these small interactions that we have, and that we should be sure that we're responding in a way that cultivates belonging rather than tears that pillar down.
Emily, thanks. We have one last question. And it involves around storytelling. In the readings that I did, you had mentioned this person named Carlos who discovered purpose. It took him years to make sense of it. You talked about redemption and going from telling a story and going from bad to good versus good to bad, which can have a reverse effect, and that you want to keep people kind of moving forward. So as people start to think about that, I think it can be, you know, obviously it can be a very powerful thing. What recommendations might you have for somebody who wants to get on that, you know, bad to good track? They want to be able to create that mindset of powerful storytelling. What recommendations can people use to kind of get started there?
So Carlos, who you mentioned, the way that he was somebody who, he was a child in Cuba during the Cuban Revolution. He got separated from his parents, came to the United States, was an orphan for a time, had a difficult life. And so that was a major break in his narrative that he had to make sense of. And the way he started making sense of it is by writing about it. So he eventually wrote a beautiful memoir called Waiting for Snow in Havana. And I think that there's an insight there about what we can all do, and an insight that's supported by the research, which is to just begin writing about it. If you have some kind of experience that you're trying to make sense of, whether it's a major turning point experience in your life that, like Carlos is about, you know, leaving his homeland, leaving his family, or something more minor, like a difficult experience that you had with your boss or your husband or wife or whatever, just start writing about it. I keep a journal, and a lot of people do, and I think it's a practice that's helped me in this regard. You know, there's a body of research around writing about difficult life experiences that shows that, you know, when people come into the lab and they take their most traumatic experiences and write about them for 15 minutes a day for 3 or 4 days in a row, they end up finding more meaning in that experience. And they end up doing so in a number of ways. One is that the researchers put it in this way, they start using more of what are called insight words. So words like because and why and understand. The more they write about it, the more they come to this kind of deeper wisdom about why what happened and how it's affected their lives. The second thing that happens is they shift their perspective. So instead of focusing so much on why this happened to me, they stand outside of themselves and understand why this person did this or what were the bigger circumstances that led to this. And finally, the writing leads them to find some sort of positive or some sort of silver lining that resulted from the experience. So maybe they grew, maybe they developed a new life purpose as a result of it. With Carlos, he talks about how his experience deepened his spiritual faith and led him to ultimately becoming a professor of history, so finding his purpose in that capacity. So I think there's something really powerful about writing that can bring us to these deeper meanings and insights.
I appreciate that very much. Yeah, I think definitely deepen insights. Journaling is the way you describe journaling. You did it very well. There's a huge benefit to journaling and not just keeping a diary. So thank you.
Well, Emily, it was great to have you join us today. Again, I really enjoyed your book and highly recommend it. I give it to clients often. And how can people follow your work going forward? What's the best way for people to find you and follow what you're doing?
My website, Emily Esfahani Smith. My Twitter is M Esfahani Smith, so people can find me online and on social media.
Great. Well, thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emily. Have a great day. Thanks again.
Great to be able to talk with Emily. I will highly recommend her book. It is well worth the read. I often say that some of the best books about retirement are not about retirement, and this is certainly top of the list in my mind. Dennis, what were the things that jumped out to you about the conversation? What are your takeaways?
By the way, that's well said. Best books, no retirement necessarily, not about retirement. So yeah, this is a really important topic from the standpoint purpose and meaning. People tend to think of this thing as something much bigger than it is. So she helped kind of demystify it. So I liked a couple of things that she said in particular jumped out at me that I think are great tips. One was small acts is where you can find purpose doing what you do and do it well. Really think about that. It's in the small acts we do that it doesn't have to be, Joe, you referenced, you know, climbing the Himalayas or something. It doesn't have to be that. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. And it really makes it simpler for people and gives them a much more fulfilling opportunities here. The other thing was take the best of who you are. That's a powerful phrase when you really think about it. Who are you? What do you value? What's really at your core? And use that and give that to others. And the last thing, and we kind of talked about it a little bit when we chatted with her, about adapting this service mindset. Do for others, gratitude, be thankful, but do good things for other people. And it really does demystify the whole aspect of searching for purpose. Happiness is optional, comes and goes, but purpose and the related purpose and meaning that people get in their lives can be really long-lasting. Joe, what jumped out at you?
Two things. First, the difference between meaning and happiness. That if you're going to go for one, purpose and meaning are the better bets, because clearly happiness is a great thing, but can be fleeting. And the second thing is really how accessible she made it, meaning so much of this is under our control, more than we might think about sometimes. She talked about how you can start to journal and that can lead to insights. You can create community, as she's done with the Ben Franklin circles that she started in DC. You can cultivate belonging. you can really find meaning in those small interactions. And I like what you said about really thinking about those little moments, that they're really packed with meaning, and to reframe how we think about a number of things, including those. Welcome to our noteworthy segment, where we discuss an article that we think is worth your time. Today's article is from Next Avenue, a site that we frequent often, and it's Kick Back or Live with Purpose, Why Choose? New research shows it's a false dichotomy for people over 50. It's written by two of the researchers, Ann Colby and Jim Emmerman, and it summarizes the key findings of a study that was conducted recently at the Stanford Graduate School of Education with Encore.org. They took a look at 34 million people over 50 that put purpose beyond themselves front and center in everyday lives. So over one-third of the adults over 50 that they surveyed describe themselves as purposeful beyond their own interests. And a couple of things that jumped out at me about this article and the study was, first, that purposeful people were found to have a positive outlook, and there were a lot of benefits that stemmed from that. And then the second one is that it actually is high on people's lists of goals. When they looked at what are people's top personal goals, about 20% had something that related to purpose beyond themselves. How about you, Dennis? What jumped out to you about this article?
Yeah, just piggyback off that. I think those are great insights. I had a lot of the same. The purpose, the connection to a positive outlook on life, I thought was very important. The positivity manufactured itself in the traits that people have when they really focused on a purpose. And I noticed in the article, it actually says positivity refers to joy, hopefulness, optimism, and other related emotions. The other thing is the whole idea of freedom. Now, freedom is important to purposeful and non-purposeful people, but in different ways. What I got from that, and why I thought it was important, is that people who are non-purposeful generally are moving away from something. And the article actually points out meant freedom from burdensome responsibilities, freedom from having to get up in the morning and go to work. Whereas more positive people looked at freedom as an opportunity and an avenue for them to get more involved in going, moving forward and expanding their self and making a difference with things that they care about. I think it also kind of echoes some of the things that Emily said. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It can start with small acts. Small acts are probably the key thing. There are clear benefits. The article also points out to people who are looking at improving, at boost your mental and your physical health. So an article worth reading, and certainly a good connection to be purposeful, find meaning.
So thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Retirement Conversation. You'll find the link to this article, Kick Back or Live with Purpose, Why Choose, from Next Avenue in our show notes, along with information and links to Emily Esfahani-Smith's book, her TED Talk, and other resources you may be interested in the show notes. Thanks again, and look forward to connecting with you again soon.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Retirement Conversation with Emily Esfahani-Smith. You can get future episodes by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, or by visiting our website at retirementwisdom.com. Until next time, Joe and Dennis signing off.